mean, I love us in this room. And they tell me that love can ward off gloom. I like to fancy that. When I get scared, I only have to see myself in you. I only try to do it like you do. It seems to pull me through. Oh, I took a few plays.
This is Queer Voices on KPFT, and this segment is called Queer Music Heritage. I'm J.D. Doyle, and this is one of those rare editions of QMH where I'm devoting the entire show to one artist, and there's no question that she merits this attention. She's iconic in the genre of women's music, and her name is Farron. So stay with me to hear an exclusive interview with her, and we'll talk about her music in general and quite a number of her songs in particular. But for perhaps my younger listeners, let me give a quick introduction to Farron. She was born in Toronto and was raised in a small working-class community on the west coast of Canada, near Vancouver. She started writing songs as a teenager and into her 20s had to take a variety of jobs to make ends meet. At age 25 in 1977, she released her first album, called Farron, on her own label and printed up just 1,000 copies. It was a two-track acoustic project, and a year later, she repeated this effort with 1,000 copies of her second release, called Farron Backed Up, getting that name since it included some backup musicians. These two releases attracted enough attention that by 1980, she was able to borrow enough to record her first studio album. That album, called Testimony, paved the way for her real start, with critical acclaim and national touring. Let's skip ahead a bit. You've heard me talk about Hot Wire magazine before, and I interviewed its editor on my show last September. It was a magazine about women's music, and one I very much respected. In 1992, it featured a reader's poll, and Farron was voted all-time favorite performer. And in 1993, 13 years after its release, Testimony was voted all-time favorite album. Other outstanding albums by her have included Shadows on a Dime, Phantom Center, Still Riot, and Driver. Her lyrics are personal, poetic, and powerful, and the Boston Globe paid her high praise by saying, "Someday they will call Dylan the Farron of the 60s." I interviewed Farron just a few months after the release of her first album in 9 years, and she tells us about the new album and touches on the journey during these recent years.
The new CD is called Turning Into Beautiful, and what I love about that CD is that it took about another 9 years since the last CD to record, and it's just like a soup. It's just more seasoned, more reflective on what it's like getting older with all its losses and its gains.
Your new album, Turning Into Beautiful, opens with the song More Than That, in which you sing, "Hello, my friends, I feel so happy to be back, to feel so clear and on the track." It's a beautiful welcoming to your album. Can you elaborate on that sentiment?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of that kind of attitude through the whole CD, which is, what do I mean when I say it's more than that? Well, anybody in the know knows what I mean. You know, it's like sometimes it takes a long time to, A, realize that where you are is okay, and that's where you are, or else it takes you a long time to get back to where you were. and am I happy to be back? Am I happy? But it's everything. It's like all the losses and all the anxieties or the questions about self or anything all the way along are there before I get back to that moment of saying, yeah, okay, I'm happy to be back at work. I'm happy to be back as an artist. I'm happy to be back on earth, or, you know, to be back willing to, you know, live my life. It's all that.
Have you found that when you think back on your early works that you perhaps learned something from what you wrote years and years ago?
Yes. I mean, and I must be a slow learner, because I mean, I've had to sing, I mean, willingly but fascinatingly, has sung many of the same songs, and as I write another CD, I add some more songs, but people still want to hear right from the very first CD. So even as I was growing older, because now it's like, I started in 75 performing. To go back and sing a song that I wrote, you know, in 1975, and find that I don't have a problem with it. I mean, it was one of the criterion for me to say, is this a good song? Could I sing it forever? And, I mean, you know, I can. I can, because somewhere the place that I'm writing from, it doesn't change. I think a cave person, you know, if they could have sung, would have sung the same song.
Has your relationship to some of those early songs changed?
Some of them I've grown more reverent toward, more respectful. It's like, how did I know that then? And how come I've forgotten it so many times since? It's almost like when when they say, you know, watch a 4 and 5 year old, you know, where they're living is pre-controlled mind, you know, and so what they're telling you is really their truth. And I feel that way about some of my early songs. Like, I knew something from an antenna or a real instinctive place that, you know, years later I had to go back and learn again, because I didn't know I'd lost it, but once I knew it, I had to go back and get it, and you can't get it the same way.
I've had artists tell me that some of their older songs became more true for them, like they grew into it.
Yeah, I had that happen with a song called It Won't Take Long. I dreamt that song. I mean, I dreamt the circumstances of the song, and then when I woke up, I didn't want to write the song because, you know, it's always complicated when art and politics mix. I mean, it means you can be bought, you can be sold, you can be, you know, it's very complicated, and I didn't want to take that kind of stand. But as it turned out, I couldn't not do the song, and I wrote it because I had to write it out of my body, and then I didn't want to sing it, but then I had to sing it out of my body, and the response to the song was very powerful, and the song still has not died. I mean, it had a little bit of a dip, you know, through the Reagan years, but then it came back, and it's back, and I sang it in November at a show with the band, and the song had a life force that really surprised me once again. You know, sometimes the songs, they do go away for a while. I don't know if they're taking a break or I'm taking a break, but there's something that goes on, and then they just take a little sleep, and then they come back.
On your new album, I love the country sound on some of the songs, with the steel guitar. Did you have those arrangements in mind when you finished writing them?
Yeah. I had gone to my producer, and basically, I mean, one of the things was, you know, you only have so much money when you're making your own CDs. And basically what I said is, you know, we're a bad plus one is what I felt I could afford, which required all my players to be as talented as they could be in the bed track sessions. And then we were going to add one more tone. And I decided, and Johnny and I decided, that the pedal steel was the tone because it has so much longing and so much heart. And so that was the instrument that is running throughout.
I've listened to it several times in a row, and my reaction is that the CD is very comforting.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's exactly what I want to hear. I mean, you know, I think when you're young, you can write, and you're supposed to write the upset and the anger and the this and the that, and it can be full of questions, and everybody's thrilled that the questions are there. But I find it kind of awkward for me as I get older to continue on that vein, because I don't really feel it. I feel like, you know, I've seen the ball bounce quite a few times. I know how high it bounces. I can't ask the question, how high bounces the ball? That's not my job now. I don't think that's my job. That's somebody else's job. You know, I want to talk about something else.
My favorite song of yours is Ain't Life a Brook. Can you tell us about that song?
Well, you know, the song Ain't Like a Brook actually was more mature than I am, or than I was when I wrote it. And sometimes I write where I'm at, and sometimes I write where I'm going. And Ain't Like a Brook is like that. It had an understanding of, for a minute when I was in that song, I had an understanding of the bittersweet trade exchange between freedom and love and possession and love. I saw what had to happen in my growth in order for me to grow. And I actually think that that song is nurtured by this one belief that I have, which is that people are instinctively intelligent and emotionally alert and desiring to be kind.
I watch you reading a book. I get to thinking our love's a polished stone. You give me a long, drawn look. I know pretty soon you're gonna leave our home. And of course I'm mine, especially when I'm thinking from my heart. But life don't clickety-clack down a straight line track. It come together and it come apart. You say you hope I'm not the kind to make you feel obliged to go digging through your time with a pain look in your eyes. You give me the furniture, we'll divide the photographs. Go out to dinner one more time, have ourselves a bottle of wine and a couple of laughs. And when first you left, I stayed so sad I wouldn't sleep. I know that love's a gift. I thought yours was mine. It's something that I could keep. Now I realize time is not the only compromise. A bird in the hand could be an all-night stand between a blazing fire and a pocket of skies. And so I hope I'm not the kind to make you feel obliged to go taking through your time with a pain look in your eyes. I covered the furniture, I framed the photographs. Went out to dinner one more time, had myself a bottle of wine and a couple of laughs. And just the other day I got your letter in the mail. I'm happy for you. It's been so long. You've been wanting a cabin and a backwoods trail. And I think that's great. Me, I seem to find myself in school. It's all okay. I just wanna say I'm sorry you didn't do it cruel. But ain't life a brook? Just when I get to feeling like a polished stone, I get me a long, drawn look. It's kind of a drag to find yourself alone, and sometimes I'm mine. Especially when I'm waiting on your heart. But life don't clickety-clack down a straight line track. It come together and it come apart. Cause I know you're not the kind to make me feel obliged to go taking through my time with a pain look in my eyes. I sold the furniture, I put away the photographs. Went out to dinner one more time, skipped a bottle of wine, had a couple of laughs. It wasn't that fun.
And that was her classic song, Ain't Life a Brook. Why do you think that song is so very popular with your fans?
You know, I had a friend tell me that you couldn't really know love until you had loved someone and left them. And first of all, that they had loved you and left, but then when you had loved and left. And at that point, you're in the realm of love, because it has to have forgiveness on both parts. I remember at the time not really knowing what the hell she was talking about, completely But as time went on, and when I look at the song Ain't Life a Brook, that's what that song's talking about. It's like, you know, to try to find a way, and I've tried to do it for years, to try to find a way to write where there are no villains. It's a wonderful place to be.
It's not she left me, it's what happened, not something inflicted.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose it's, you know, in another more general way would be to say if you have lemons, you make lemonade. I mean, it's like, what is there in, you know, in the moment and in the pain that, I mean, it's a map, too. I've heard that from people. It was, Ain't Life a Brook ended up being a map for the way out of the grieving or a way through the grieving. And, you know, I have grieved. I have loved and I have lost, and I know the terrain.
In the introduction to this show, I talked about your breakthrough album, Testimony, from 1980. Could you tell us about the title track for that album?
Testimony, the song, was written in Toronto, and what had happened was, in a nutshell, I had been asked to write a song for a film called This Film Is About Rape. And I had been gang raped when I was younger. And I went back to the police and tried to get some information. I didn't exactly know how to write this song. And in the process, you know, you could barely find the information or whatever, and was young enough to not realize the effect that this was going to have on me. Consequently, you know, in the ensuing months, I really went on a tear. I mean, I just wanted to run away from me so bad that I ended up in Toronto when I lived in Vancouver. And while I was there, I just was living, really. I knew I had to have this song by September 14th, and now it's, you know, the day before, and I still don't have the song, and it was the thing that I was running from, the thing that I was running toward. And that night, I ended up, I think it's almost like a trance. I mean, I ended up taking a walk with this very weird kind of man. I'm sure he was real, but sometimes I wonder. On a bicycle, I had a conversation with me, and then I went back home and I wrote that song, and got up in the morning and took another look at it and thought, well, I guess that's the song because this is the day. And I called them and said, I have it, you know, and so they used it, and I ended up calling it Testimony because it was like a testimonial.
There's God-like and warlike and strong-like, all is some show. And there's sad-like and mad-like and had-like we know. But by my light, be I spirit. And by my heart, be I woman. And by my eyes, be I open. And by there are waters hidden from us. In the maze we find them still. We'll take you to them. You take your young ones. May they take their own in turn. And by our lives be we spirit. And by by our eyes be we open, and by our hands be we whole.
Very nice. That was a little of the title track from Testimony. And I gave you an extra treat there. I went from Farron singing the first verse of her song to the last verse as sung by Sweet Honey and the Rock from 1983. They adored Farron's song and made it a staple of their concerts around the world. And I need to mention that in order to cover as many songs as possible on this show, I can only feature clips of the songs, and I'm going to try and cover her music in roughly chronological order. Also from the Testimony album, I've found that when I hear the song Misty Mountain, the song stays with me. I find that the next day I notice the chorus going through my head.
Misty Mountain, I was living in a friend's basement. I had a small room, and there was a couple of years in there where I was really impoverished spiritually. I didn't know what to do, and I was so full of questions and everything. And at one point, said, you know, what do you need? You know, cause I couldn't get out of bed at one period for about 3 weeks, and I was living with friends, and he said, what do you need? And I said, you know, I need a room, you know, a dark room where I can rest and, something with cedar in it so that I can play the guitar, and I like to play the guitar in the dark. So they put a bathroom down there, and it was made out of cedar, and I went in there and closed the door and just started. I felt alone, so I felt like I could really sing loud, and I just belted out those lyrics. So then I went running to the, you know, typewriter and typed them up.
Up the misty mountain, wildflowers bind the ground. Down by the rushing river, forests will wear those boulders down. Me, I'm underneath my covers. Me, I'm trapped inside my brain. Well, up above the misty mountain, up above the rushing river.
And the song Who Loses was on Testimony, but it was also on your first album from 1977.
Yeah, that would probably be the first song that I saved. I had this idea that I would just be in the now, and I would write a song and sing it, and when as soon as I forgot it, it was gone, and I didn't care. But at some point, someone said to me, you know, you should maybe be saving. So Who Loses was written in 1970. I started saving them. I wrote it down.
Old river winding, water run high. If there's gold for the finding, well, it's passing me by. How I ache for a part in a play, I could say I didn't blow.
In 1984, you released Shadows on a Dime. Please tell me about the title track.
Shadows on a Dime, I was on a train. I had flown from Santa Cruz, where I had done 2 sold-out shows, and then I was going to New York for the first time. And I was on a train, fell into a sleep, and I had already had the music. You know, sometimes you pick up the guitar on your plane and you're going over the same licks over and over. And I had this music when I woke up, the dream that I'd been dreaming, I knew fit right on that guitar pattern. And so I put them together, and it was true. I hardly had to alter anything. They just, the words and the guitar found each other. And it became, in a sense, the title track for the next CD, because the next CD was Shadows on a Dime, I think, was the CD itself, was about the price of your emotional life and your physical life and your professional life, and understanding that life was a lesson and what everything cost. So Shadows on a Dime, I mean, it was written in a dream, and it just had that feeling of the desperation of the soul that wants something, and the earth and the businesses want us to do something else with our soul. And so that's what that whole CD is about.
What does the title actually mean?
Where it comes from is when I was a kid, we were very poor, and I would always scour the streets for money. And, you know, you could only see a dime if the sun happened to shine on it, and it would glint. Otherwise, you just kind of walk right past it. And that's what I'm making a reference to, but of course there's another, it's about the luck and the fortune, you know, and the light on our soul that can happen. We can't see our goodness, we can't see our great good fortune, unless there's a light shining on it.
This window makes a perfect frame, for New England leaves like painted rain. They hold me as I hold this train, all shadows on a dime. You move forward fast by holding back. You gauge your steps and you don't look slack. Me, I'm looking backward down the track to see us dreamers in our prime. I poured my soul in Santa Cruz. I ached all night, next day I lost my shoes. It's so optional what you may or may not lose in this pattern we call time.
Is it possible to answer the question of what song that you've written are you the most proud?
A song that I wouldn't say the most proud, but that I'm continually fascinated by is Proud Crowd, Cry Cry. And the other song that I feel sorrowful for is, but I'm proud of, is Phantom Sinner. I think it was a completely overlooked song and sentiment, and maybe it was before its time.
Which of your songs is your favorite to perform?
Depends if I'm alone or if I'm with the band. Depends on the instrumentation that's around me. It depends on where I'm at. Like right now, for my own healing, the song that has been the most powerful for me on the stage is In the Meantime from Turning Into Beautiful. And in the past, of course, it has been Shadows on a Dime. If I've got my cello player, it's just a completely evocative song. Cello player and guitar player together, you know, it just kind of comes and goes. For a long time, it was Inside Track, My, very, very beautiful, peaceful space that we could get together when we were the band, just like, oh my God, it just wanted the song to never end.
From Phantom Sinner from 1990 is the song My, and it contains the line, I remember that time I told you about your love in the polished stone. That seems to be a direct reference to a line from Ain't Life a Brook.
Your love and the polished stone. It's so easy to forgive you now that I'm polishing up my home. I got to kiss the face of heaven, and then when she kissed me back, I tried to roll my lucky sevens and now I'm back on the inside track.
Yeah, and I think that was probably the first time that it occurred to me that I was only telling one story, that I, me as an artist, or what they say, an artist simply only has one story. So it didn't seem preposterous to me to go back, acknowledge that I had an intimacy with an audience, and also make reference to something from the past.
Also from Phantom Center, please tell me about the song Harmless Love.
Harmless Love, I had won a green card, and I was now going to go live in the United States, and I had written, some 10-page poem, something like akin to Paradise Lost, trying to find out my feelings about going to live in a country that was also, you know, doing things in Nicaragua and Argentina. You know, I just thought that I'm a Canadian, I'm not an American, and I had a great turmoil over that move. And I mean, how I ended up resolving it was by saying that I was going to go and share my turmoil with more people if I sang in the United States. And the night before I was leaving, I was walking down the street in Vancouver, and it was raining, and I started whistling this little melody, and I don't know why, it was just, that was the question, what's the matter with Harmless? And then I bumped into a friend, and we had to talk for a minute, and I went home, and that night I stayed up and wrote that whole song. And I think that Harmless Love and Phantom Center on the same CD was the dilemma of Phantom Center, was the whole question of it. It's like, on one hand, there's this vulgar greed and violence and disrespect for other people that exists all the time. And also, why can't we just be harmless? What, you know, why isn't that an aspiration? So that's how that song came out.
What's the matter with harmless? Take a new step in an old direction. If you think about tenderness, what's the matter with harmless love? I take a little walk outside in a town that brings me pears and peaches. I'm busting with love inside, and it's always more than it ever teaches. On the curb I pass a friend of mine. We seem a little older, maybe a little wiser. We laugh about the shades of time and marvel at love, the great sky rider. What's the matter with
harmless?
Take a new step in an old direction. If you think about tenderness, what's the matter with a hand on a hand affection? Do you dream about a new day? You gotta dream about something strong and simple. Each and every is a kind thing to say. What's the matter with harmless love?
Please tell me about Stand Up.
There were some very hard times in there. I guess that was where I tried to explain how I felt about choosing a dark room and mirrors and all the disco bars and being gay as an illicit affair and the shame. It's almost like something is built on shame. I think homophobia is internalized in all of us. It certainly was in me. And I think I was trying to talk about that. Like, there's no time now. I mean, there were various musicians and artists around who, you know, their MO was they were going to wait until they had a certain amount of, I suppose, financial clout, so that then they thought they could have political clout. But I was talking about that. It's like, well, you know, just take the space you're in, and then, you know, it's yours. Nobody can take your space of you from you. So I guess that was telling me about it.
I'm gonna stand up and let myself be. live for, stand up now. I got my one life, the words that do amount to if I don't learn how to love you, love myself beside you, makes the gentle and proud. I want to love life, the vision in the world, can we stand up?
From your album Driver from 1994, there's a line in your song, Girl on the Road, that says, I wanted to turn beautiful and serve eternity. And the title of your new album is Turning Into Beautiful. Is there a connection to those messages?
You know what? It was totally unconscious. But later, what happened was, after I had written Turning Into Beautiful, and then I was back on stage doing a show, I'm singing Girl on the Road, and I got to that line, and I about stopped singing. I just was, inside of my head was like, huh. Wow.
Good. I didn't want to think I was imagining it.
Yeah. Boy, you've noticed it all. I mean, I actually hadn't thought about it at the time, but I did later when I, like I said, when I was right in the middle of singing it. Oh, my God.
Can you tell me about the song itself?
Girl on the Road. I was in Chicago at the Folk Music, School of Folk Music, and we were touring the Canadian Festival Tour. I was the headliner, and a bunch of Canadians, we were doing this thing through the States, which was kind of laughable. I mean, it didn't go over very well. And the sound checks were forever because there was like five acts or something, and I was always last. I went into this back room, and there was an old school desk, the kind with the inkwell. And when I was young, at home, in my family life, I would hide down in the basement, and there was an old school desk, and I'd write. And so I went and put myself in that desk, and, you know, it's like as if the desk was holding the song, and when I sat down, it just ended up just being the story of my life. And I think then that was in 1989 or 90 or something like that. And I wasn't sure about continuing doing music. That was a hard tour. And I think that song was myself telling me that there really was no other rock to carry, or there was nothing else to do. This was the thing to do. And it was, and that writing and singing had been the thing that had freed me from all the other things that were in the other verses. The darkness in my family life, the idea of love affairs that didn't work out, the sense of freedom that I thought I had and couldn't find, and you know, all of it's in there, and a forgiveness and a compassion that I ultimately only got from doing music and letting the song teach me. And so that's what Girl on the Road is about.
I don't know what it's like for you, but here's what it's like for me. I wanted to turn beautiful and serve eternity. Never follow money or love with greasy hands, or move the earth and waters just to make it fit my plans. My eyes would be the harbor, my words the perfect place for a girl on the road.
The song Love Loves Me has kind of a Cajun feel to it.
Very sardonic. Yeah, it's like understanding what love does. It just puts you through the ringer, and that's how you learn. You know, that's what it is. It's like you're not going to go on the Ferris wheel and think you're not going to spin around.
Today I need my water wide, and my tears trapped tight in a thimble cup. A fire burned me up inside, and my darkness screams mercy up. Mercy up and let me ride. I looked into my lover's eyes, and my lover's eyes looked past me. Yeah. would sidle past the sorrow gate and be stoning of the paver road that would marry her with tomorrow's fate. And those pond-like eyes and Chevron smile that hints that more awaits us. But now I know where love resides, and I finally know what love does.
Another very popular album for you came out in 1996 and was called Still Riot. Would you please tell me about the song Still Riot and what it means?
It was the beginning of my elder perspective, in the sense that all of us got older. We ended up with kids or mortgages or decisions that we thought we'd never make, and we did because we had to. And you just couldn't know when you were 20 that how life would put you in such a jam. At the same time, there's a certain grace and a meditation to life. And what I wanted to say, and I hoped I said, was that to change the world, sometimes it's to stay still. And sometimes even when you're meditating, you're changing the world with fury. And so that it was two things. Still riot, meaning please continue. And also that the change as we get older happens on the inside.
Every person has their story, the one they vamp and revamp. There is a way through constant sorrow, but we must do more than light the lamp. Unlike Gervalo at the window, finding Lara's love. We dare not wait the weather to join the high-suspended dove. Yesterday my baby girl walked up to a little boy, and I watched her curl her arms around him and transform her fear to joy. If I believe we've blown our promise, then I might have missed the chance. You see Gandhi and two baby buddies, I watch them spin and dance. You gotta go for what you know so well. You gotta go for why you came this way and live your story tall and well.
Also from Still Riot, please tell me about Alice Says Yes.
I actually had a friend inside of Warner Brothers who didn't know how to be in a relationship, and it was something that when we spoke about it, he really wanted, and he really just wanted to be in a couple, and we had a nickname for each other that was Alice. I was Alice and he was Allison. And so, you know, we'd had a talk, and I said, well, you know, it's just all about being willing. Alice said yes, and so I wrote that song for him. I mean, I wrote it for him, but also it's how I think it is. You know, I think sometimes you know, you have to make a choice and you weigh out whether are you lonely enough? Are you empty enough? Have you finally learned enough that you're willing to, you know, give to another person? And, when you get that down, then you can stop being the person who's driving around on the road peering in other people's lives, you know. When I was a kid, that was like a night out with the family, was driving around looking at everybody else's house.
First comes the kiss, then comes the hands too hot to touch, feeling like I wanna be with you so much. Driving to work in the morning, everyone's house looks warm inside. I can't believe what I'm thinking. I gotta be out of my mind. When you give me a cactus, figure you're telling me how it is. We make love as a cosmic shower. And I ask you, are we friends too? I talk to my sister about it all, to see what she did when she was here. She tells me don't give up. Your freedom is not so clear. I'm alive in my center, and true to the core is how I feel. I don't believe I have entered the place she says when nothing's real. You give me a heart shape of
the production of the song The Chosen Ones captures a certain mood and then evolves.
Yeah, The Chosen Ones is again the commitment or the recommitment to realize that there's only, you know, you're living and you're witnessing. And that song opens up Phil Riott from a fade in, and you hear all the chatter and, you know, laughing and everybody's happy. But I have so many times been in rooms like that and just like completely alone. And so, you know, I said to Donnie, how do we get that feeling? Because the whole direction of Still Riott is that you cannot have a life unless you participate. If you don't participate, you're not there. Therefore, the end of the CD is this incredible 100 people choir. And the beginning is a chatter and this person having their own kind of quiet, nervous breakdown about being on the outside and not knowing how to get in. And the chosen ones are the, in a sense, is the person who, if you're envious, you look out and say, well, they're lucky, they're the chosen ones. And on the other hand, to go through the process is to be the chosen one. So I hope that makes sense to you.
I think of all those people with their love and understanding, how they wear it like they had it from the start. I must have been the other kind, the kind with just a lonely mind and heart. From where you stand, you're an attractive reflection. And where I stand, I'm mostly on my knees. From there I said hello, felt something small and slow say please, please, please. And though it's just a thought, it's such a saving shot. For every person there's a rhyme and a reason to decide to be the chosen one to stand among the broken ones.
One more from Still Riott. The song Venus as Appearances has a very different feel for you.
Yeah. And what had happened for that song was that years before, you know, in Canada, I live on an island and up, we have a mountain. And on the top of the mountain for July 4th or 1st, that weekend, we go up there and we sleep in sleeping bags and actually stay up most of the night. And when we were up there one time, one of the gals that was part of the party said that Venus was really only in the sky half the year. The other half the time it only seemed to be there. I mean, I have no idea what the truth in that, but I just thought that was a very interesting concept. And so the song Venus as Appearances is really about that, about how things seem like there's something when they're really something else. And the lessons come from the other. Not what you thought they were.
She told me about a silver lake, the type behind a rock face. Your basic demons tell you fools come late. I thought maybe I should go back.
Have your feelings changed about your songwriting over the years?
I respect it more. I see now, you know, when I put it all out, like if I had to, you know, when I have to type up something for, like I have to type up Still Riot for the web page, or, you know, had everything together for a minute because I thought I would do an anthology of all the songs, the book, of all the lyrics. And I started looking at it, and, you know, it is a whole and searching spiritual life that I put on paper.
And how has your audience changed?
The audience is the same. I mean, we started out together. We grew older together. They don't go out as much, our age group. I think that there's younger people, but they come to it the same way. If they're that kind of person who is interested in putting poetry and music and, you know, the soul thirst together. I have a feeling that in years to come, there's going to be some kind of, I don't know how to say it, like an exposure of the kind of music that I did that will come up again. I understand I'm now in the encyclopedia, which someone just told me the other night. That stunned me. And, you know, I get used for people doing their dissertations and stuff. Very interesting.
You've been an out musician for many years. Has your image of that changed over the years? Is it more important now? Less important?
It's always important. I mean, a kind of an honest presentation, the ability to live with yourself is always important. I don't think it becomes any less. It certainly had more of a price tag on it when I decided that I wouldn't be in the closet. But it just depended on what you thought you were paying. I mean, I grew up surrounded by, you know, deception and secrets, and I just couldn't stand it, and I couldn't perpetrate it in my own life. I would rather have died, actually. And so, you know, if there was more at stake for me to lie about myself than there was to tell the truth, because I wouldn't be able to live.
On the lighter side, how did you get the name Farron?
My name Farron was given to me by a couple of friends who, I don't know, somebody had a dream. And at a certain point in my life, I was called Rusty. I mean, no one even knew what to call me. And so they said, oh, this is your name, it's Farron. And I'm like, well, what's that? I don't know, but that's what it is. And in the dream, there was three of us, and that was my name. And so that would be back in the very early 70s. And first time I went somewhere to try to sing, the guy's like very gruff, and he's like, what's your name, you know? So I said, Farron.
In the year 2000, Farron released a double CD retrospective album called Impressionistic, and it includes 28 songs covering all of her career. In an ad for your CD Impressionistic, Lady Slipper Music said, neither she nor we would suggest that anyone ought to listen to a double Farron CD all at one sitting. Do you agree with that comment?
Actually, that's what I said. Because, you know, of course, I had to listen to it to get it ready. And it was just like, oh my God, you know, all the different images and feelings. And then there's some kind of cohesion, because it was the same voice through the whole thing that... it just made it almost too much. I actually thought that was going to be my last CD. You know, after the Warner Brothers thing, then the band, we just kind of split up. And actually, other than Shelley, my guitar player, I never saw anybody anymore. My producer and I ended up in a conversation, and I just thought spiritually and emotionally just in the same sort of bland place that, you know, maybe it's time to take a stab at this again.
In 1999, Farron recorded a unique album for her at June Millington's Institute for the Musical Arts, or IMA. The album is called Inside Out. It's an album of cover songs, and I love that album for some of the same reasons you'll hear her talk about.
Inside Out actually was about the songs that I had grown up with, that, you know, listening on my transistor as I walked in, you know, junior high, and being completely fascinated with the music. And not, I mean, I still really don't know music theory. I couldn't tell you anything about music. And we went back and just recleaned those songs. For me, it was a thrill to see how simple some of them were musically, and some of them were very complicated.
How did you pick the songs for that album?
I picked the songs because they were the songs that I loved growing up. Town Without Pity, I heard from a movie, and I was completely mesmerized by that. I would have been kind of young, but as time went on, you know, I pulled it back. All of those songs were just songs that, I mean, I think the only thing I would have added to it was Society's Child, you know, because that was the other song that really mattered.
Which track is your favorite from it?
What Becomes of the Brokenhearted, the Ruffin song. And man, was it hard to sing. I mean, he must have had huge lungs. And for me, I mean, I ended up feeling bruised by the time because if you really ever notice the line, there's nowhere to breathe.
Right, it just carries the thought and carries it and carries it.
And you know, man, I wanted to own that song, and I really had to practice.
As I walk this land of broken dreams, I have visions of many things, but happiness is just an illusion, filled with sadness and confusion. What becomes of the broken hearted who have loves that have now departed? I'm more back to find some kind of peace of mind, maybe.
Town Without Pity, I think it's a fascinating song, and it also was a real, you know, you had to sing it. And Walk Away, Renee, you know, these are, I'm telling you, my favorites on that in terms of me being completely connected and getting it from the inside out. Walk Away, Renee was a tearjerker. And Don't Worry, Baby, you know, really fascinated me.
There's like a who's who of women's music helping you in that recording. An all-star cast, June and Jean Millington, Adrian Torv, Mary Watkins, Teresa Trahl, Barbara Higbee, Rhiannon, Gwen Avery, Chris Williamson, Trent Fury.
Yeah, that was when we lived at IMA, when I lived at IMA, and we had a studio, recording studio off the kitchen.
What are the hardest lessons you have learned from your over 30 years of writing and performing music?
Well, quite often you're only as good as your last song. And you have to keep some sense of yourself together. It's hard to learn that about how fickle a media culture is. You know, I've had some absolutely loyal followers all of my life, and when we brought out Turning Into Beautiful and put it, you know, on the web, and I had a web page and everything, there was a way then for people to communicate with me, and I just couldn't believe some of the letters that I got. But at the same time, every time there's a decade, and I don't mean it by the years, but by the birth of people, you have to figure out how you're going to jump the decade into the next generation of person. And if you're not in the system, it's really tricky. It's really tricky. So that was a hard thing to learn. By the same token, it was hard for me to accept my worth to other people. Because sometimes left alone, it's a really small, dark room, and I don't have a way out. And yet there's a whole bunch of people, thousands of people, who hold me. It's incredible esteem. And I am not able to match it. Like, that's been the hardest thing for me to learn.
The pressures of being almost a cult figure?
And maybe that's what, I don't know what it's called. It's about learning, it's about realizing at a certain point in your life that other people possibly loved you more than you did. That's a sad lesson. And also kind of curious, so, you know.
Maybe appreciate is a better word.
Yeah, I mean, it's a more distant word. But I mean, if you saw some of the letters, appreciate is not strong enough. I mean, there are people who, I think, used some of the songs to actually make it from point A to point B without offing themselves. You know, and in some ways, so did I. I mean, I had to make meaning out of a meaningless life.
I want to slip in a couple clips of songs by Farron that you may not know about, as they do not appear on her albums. In 1998, a various artists tribute album was released called Remembering Kate Wolfe. She was a very respected artist who died in 1987. It's rare for Farron to do a duet, but on this album, she and singer-songwriter Greg Brown sing Kate Wolfe's song, Tequila and Me.
The telephone is ringing, the radio is singing, the song I know much too well. As I pick up the phone, you're all alone. Who's calling? I really can't. Can't see it's tequila and me spending the night with the walls.
That was Farron and Greg Brown. And in 2002, Greg Brown got his own tribute album. Farron has long been one of the influences in Greg's work, so she was a natural to contribute her version of his song, Where is Maria?
There's a sweater, two shirt, thrown over a chair. An old photo of Anna Manana in her underwear. There's an old dog barking at a brand new moon. And a sign in every window saying, be back soon. Oh, but where's Maria? Fellow walking in a thumb-thumb car, and he's smug as a commentator on NPR. And our foolish government tries to save face while the whole world struggles to become one bland place. So but where's Maria?
From the album Going Driftless, an artist's tribute to Greg Brown, was a little of Where is Maria. The album also includes songs done by Lucinda Williams, Annie DeFranco, Sean Colvin, Mary Chapin Carpenter, and many others. As a side note, it happens that all of the artists contributing to this tribute album were women, and the effect of them singing his songs make many of them appear to have lesbian lyrics, which is a nice side benefit. I started the show with Farron's latest album, Turning Into Beautiful, released late last year. It's her first album of original material in 9 years. Did some of your fans express an impatience because it was 9 years since your last album of original material? Like, Where Have You Been? I Needed You?
Not impatience, but definitely that they were really sort of happy that my voice was back. And I never got the sense of impatience. I mean, it's like when I think about me waiting for Ricky Lee come back, you know, after she'd had her fame and everybody knew that she was somewhere hurting herself. You just pray before Magazine came out or something, you know, that I felt sad that I would have to live out the rest of my life without hearing her voice. And then she came back, you know. And it was true. She was really gone, you know. She was hurting herself.
From Turning Into Beautiful, please talk about the song, In the Meantime.
In the Meantime is, I was at a writing retreat, and we had to have 24 hours of silence, and we had to go up a mountain, and we had to look for something or ask for something, and I wanted a sign about a father that I didn't And by the time I came down from the mountain, what I realized, and I was very disappointed up at the top because there was no clear sign that I got, but by the time I came down, I understood that everything I am is because of what I got and didn't get. And so, in a sense, the wound from his abandonment is also what gave me the understanding about abandonment and how to treat people. So that's what that song is about. And in the meantime, meaning here on Earth time, it's like, you know, that is the story of living, that you're going to learn from what you get and from what you don't get.
So many people are so broken, and this story is broken too. We go looking for forgiveness for things we did or didn't do. In our hearts, we know we're goodness. In our souls, we feel the call to be someone for somebody, each other, one and all. On the mountain, I have walked upon my knees. I have crawled along the rubble of broken promises and not met needs. And the thing that I was looking for, and the thing I could not see, was the image of a perfect girl, the one I'd never be.
Tell me about the title track for Turning Into Beautiful.
I guess it's the same message that I've always been trying to get across, but in yet another way. It's like, we can't love somebody until we can love ourselves. Sometimes we are easier on other people than we are on ourselves. And so there's this whole thing of turning into beautiful, in the sense that, I mean, I've had it happen. People look at me, they think that I don't even mean that in a lover sense. I just mean they value me more than I'm able to value myself. And sometimes I think the whole thing about, you know, stopping the disrespect we have for our children and just all the ways that we treat each other could be, it requires that we also feel better about ourselves. So that's what Turning Into Beautiful is about.
Learning to sense the love. Beautiful place.
That was the song Turning Into Beautiful, and I'm down to the last song of the show. But before I get to it, I want to thank you all for listening, and I want to especially thank Farron for the wonderful interview. She's an artist I've been wanting to interview for quite some time, and the release of her new album provided the perfect opportunity. And as I knew would happen, the interview was so good that I could not fit all of it into the radio version of this show. So my internet listeners could hear an extended version with a lot more comments and additional music. That, of course, can be found at www.queermusicheritage.com. And as always, if you have questions or comments about any of the music I featured, please write me at qmheritage@aol.com. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT Houston. For my closing song, I can't resist grabbing another track from the 1999 album Inside Out. That's the album with all the delicious cover versions of songs from the 60s. So here's my last question for Farron. Since I love songs that are lyrically gay, I just love how that worked out with My Girl.
I know. Well, that was the other part of Inside Out, was that growing up a teenager, I didn't know that I was gay. I mean, it wasn't sexual in any way, but there was something that wasn't working out lyrically. And so it was really great all those years later, that, like I said on the jacket, be able to go back and, you know, sing the song without changing the lyrics and have them be true.
On a cloudy day, and when it's cold outside, I got the month of May. I guess you'll say, what can make me feel this way? Talking about my girl,
my girl.
I got so much honey, the bees envy me. I got the sweetest song.